Across the state in St. Louis, you can ride a real-life steamboat more or less just like Mark Twain did, minus the mustache. Today's steamboat rides are a novelty for tourists, but before railroads in the early 19th century, steamboats carried hundreds of tons of cargo and passengers. They connected the frontier with the world. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's show, we're talking about the role steamboats played in the settlement of Kansas City. To start things off, Christina Leffring takes us on board a replica to get a taste of what it was like to travel this way back in the day.
It's another overcast day in Hannibal, Missouri, Mark Twain's hometown. We're 20 minutes away from chugging off on the Mark Twain riverboat. So far, it's just my boyfriend and I, when... On cue, cars pull into the parking lot and flocks of families enter the gift shop to buy tickets. Kids pop 51 cents into a penny press, and out comes their stretched pennies with the image of a riverboat. They've come to experience the river the way Twain experienced it. The Mark Twain was built in the 1960s and comes with a diesel engine instead of steam and doesn't have a large paddle wheel in the back, unfortunately. But otherwise, it's a good replica of 19th century steamboats, with its wide decks stacked onto each other, each becoming narrower like a tiered cake. We enter on the lower deck. It's enclosed, air-conditioned, decorated in deep red, and smells like popcorn. Captain Steve Terry co-owns the boat with his wife. He says that riverboats today are mainly for tourism, but back in the 19th century, they had a very different role.
We're on the main deck right now. This had been pretty much open because this is where they would have stored the cotton bales, the barrels, the livestock and whatnot would have all been on this deck. Back in those days, freight was the number one thing. That's what paid the bills.
That's why, according to historian Patrick Dobson, freight took priority over lower level passengers, the people who only paid $3 or $4 for a ticket west.
Most steamboat captains loaded cargo and animals first, and then passengers took up whatever place they could on the deck. The deck passengers were just regular people who had to bring their own food. They took their chances with the elements. They basically lived outside.
Historian Paula Rose describes the journey of deck passengers this way.
You were riding right alongside the hot boilers. You were riding with other passengers and livestock and cargo. It was very crowded, sweaty, dirty, smelly. It was not a fun way to travel, but it did. It got you out west. You might be able to start a new life.
Meanwhile, on the upper decks, the cabin passengers paid double what the deck passengers did, but had their own private room and a very different experience. They ate in stately dining rooms, were served cuisine on par with the finest hotels. They drank in bars with gambling tables. Or they lounged on the deck and watched the river.
There were two absolutely different experiences on a steamboat, and that also reflected the class structure of the United States at large at that time.
But regardless of whether you were rich or poor, the river was dangerous. Once we've all boarded, the Mark Twain leaves its landing and heads out onto the river. Most passengers sit outside on the upper level at the front of the boat to watch the river engorged with rain, deceptively serene on the surface. Carol Lewis grew up in Hannibal and was raised to respect and fear the river.
It's dangerous. My parents ingrained in me, you don't go in the river. The current is strong and look at all the debris in it. But I love the river. It's pretty, it's big. It's mighty.
In the early 19th century, this would have been a hazardous trip, particularly when traveling on the Missouri, says Captain Terry.
The Missouri River was notorious for eating boats. The average lifespan of a newly built steamboat back in Sam Clemens' era was 2 years. On the Mississippi River, it was 4 to 5 years.
There were about 289 steamboats that sank, or possibly more, on the Missouri River in the mid-19th century.
That's Paula Rose again. She works at the Steamboat Arabia Museum in Kansas City.
The Arabia sank by hitting a tree snag, which was very common, but also boiler explosions were common, and people would die in those situations.
Patrick Dobson says that if the river and the boat didn't get you, the other passengers might.
Most people had to worry about being getting their stuff stolen or taken from them.
With gambling and booze on board, riverboats developed a reputation. Even captains weren't necessarily trustworthy. Some captains hired professional gamblers to take money from their passengers, or worse.
There were instances of captains getting people off of the boat so they could get over a certain kind of impediment, like a sandbar or gravel bar, and then just leaving the passengers and not coming back.
While we drift downstream on the Mississippi, I notice we still haven't completely tamed the river. There's life under the surface and in the brush along the bank. Unlike trains or planes, on a riverboat, the world slowly passes by, time slows, and you can take in the splash of fish, the chirp of birds, the smooth glide of a hawk or eagle. Even though I know about its dangerous and dirty past, I understand the nostalgia for that slower, wilder time.
Wow, thanks for that story, Christina. I cannot imagine a form of travel that comes with the danger of being stranded on a riverbank because the captain can just be like, forget you guys, I made it over the sandbar and I'm not turning back. Of course, being stranded in an airport is not a picnic either. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in the Central Standard Studio with David Hawley. He joins us from the Steamboat Arabia Museum in the River Market. Hi, David.
Good morning, Gina. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
We've heard a really vivid account of what it was like to ride on a steamboat, but it's still hard to grasp the significance of the steamboat in the history of our city. We're so used to thinking about railroads as the agents of settlement and change.
Yep. You know, and when people drive over that Missouri River across bridges and they look down on it, they really have no sense of history of what that river and the importance that it was to Kansas City and to all the towns along the river. That was the highway back in those days. And yes, I've heard the narrative so far this morning, and it was a dangerous river, and it was a hard thing to travel on these old boats. But you know, traveling overland in those days was no picnic either. When you think about having horses and wagons and having to feed and care for your horses along the trail. And then the roads were horrible. You know, and when it rained, they were ruddy and they were filled with mud. And, you know, it was not like traveling I-70.
The 19th century sounds so damp. I mean,
well, I know. But, you know, I think it probably, you know, 500 years from now, people will look back and say the same thing about our time. It's all relative.
Yeah, like I can't believe you guys took off your shoes every time you needed to go somewhere.
Oh, no. No, but yeah, exactly right. You know, but when the steamboats came along and people could compare the travel on a steamboat compared to that of overland, oh, there was no comparison. Steamboats was the way to go. Was it super comfortable in our standard of travel? No, probably not. But to them, that was first class. They cooked fabulous foods for you. You had the best food on steamboats than you did in most hotels. And that is true today when you take cruises. I mean, the cruise lines are known for the food that they serve, as was steamboats.
I want to jump in and ask you how Kansas City changed after the first steamboat landing was established. First, tell the story of that establishment and then paint a picture of the before and after.
Well, in the early days of Kansas City, there were towns around that were far bigger. St. Joe, Missouri, was bigger than Kansas City. Westport, Missouri, was there before there was a Kansas City. And one of the merchants in Westport was a fellow named John McCoy, who, to supply his store and his settlement, had to get into a wagon and took a one-day travel. You couldn't do this in one day, all the way out to Independence, actually down to a little place called Wayne City, which is north of Independence by a couple of miles at the bank of the river, load up at steamboats there. Now we're talking the 1830s, and then travel all the way back to Westport. And came up one day with an idea of saying, well, look, instead of traveling all the way there, why don't we just suggest a steamboat come west to a little place on the river that had a natural outcropping of rock and ask the steamboat to please come west a few more miles. And in 1832, a boat called the
We're going to get the name of that boat very shortly, but it sounds like
the name of that boat, yeah.
Little suspense. It sounds like our break is on the way, so we're going to have to pick it back up. When Central Standard returns, more on how the steamboat shaped our region, and then a visit to Northeast Missouri, where a religious rehabilitation facility is a saving grace for some and a deeply traumatic experience for others. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman here with David Hawley. Let's dive right back into this discussion about how steamboats shaped our city. David, we were just talking about the first steamboat landing established by a fellow named McCoy.
John McCoy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So pick right back up where you left off.
And so in 1832, a steamboat called the John Hancock came west and pulled up at a natural outcropping of rock. There at the foot of Grand Street, what is Grand Street today? Back in those days, it was called Market Street. But there at that location, this natural outcropping of rock would serve for many, many years to be the landing place where steamboats would come. And the landing there in Independence at Blue Mills Landing, or Wayne City Landing as it was often called, would eventually wash away and sand would form and the river landing would be lost. Kansas City then would be the primary recipient of the freight. And from that
what
place...
What kind of freight? What kinds of goods were traveling this way?
Well, a trip to the Arabia Steamboat Museum would show exactly that. On that boat, which sank in 1856, there was over 200 tons of freight. Shoes and clothes and food and dishes and guns, all the things that people needed on the frontier, and even homes. You could even order a prefabricated home to be shipped on a steamboat. As a matter of fact, the first house built in Omaha, Nebraska, came up on a steamboat in 1857, the year after the Arabia would sink. And so merchandise of all types and from around the world. I mean, we had international freight certainly by that time, and you could have things from all over the world brought way out here to the frontier on steamboats.
So how is Kansas City different after the steamboat landing arrives?
Well, it began to grow. On the bank of the river then, you would have a settlement would start, and it would grow and grow and grow. And it continued on until the railroad bridge in 1869 crossed the Hannibal Bridge, crossed the Missouri River, that brought rail to Kansas City. And at that point, Kansas City exploded in terms of its growth.
When was that? When did rail come to Kansas City?
By 1869.
So that's interesting.
The Hannibal Bridge was built. Yeah.
Because in the time period we're talking about, the heyday of steamboat travel, and where the steamboat was the primary source of goods and just access to the rest of the world, mm-hmm. railroads did already exist. They just didn't come here. Why didn't they come here?
They were on their way. There was rail into St. Louis by 1855. And a number of the products brought, even on the steamboat Arabia, came by rail. Part of the way. You could see railroad labels on some of the crates. Jefferson City, Missouri had rail by 1856. And so you could go as far west as that. But then a little at a time, it would continue along the river. And it would, because the river was flat and it was an easy place to lay the railroad tracks. And in those early days, many of the railroad companies even owned their own steamboats. And they would bring freight and the rails and the needed things to build the rail system by riverboat.
But do I understand correctly? I feel like there was a political piece to this, too, having to do with the Missouri Compromise, which maintained a balance of slave states and free states before the Civil War, theoretically keeping both sides happy. But then Kansas and Nebraska territories weren't organized. They couldn't expand, and so they couldn't expand a railroad through those areas. Is that right?
Well, they would eventually do all those things, but Kansas, you know, was open to settlement in 1854. It became a state in 1861. Nebraska, 1867, was when that became a state. They would eventually all get rail, but the steamboats coming west along those routes were here first. They weren't as organized. The steamboat lobby in Washington was nearly as powerful as that of the rail. And when the railroad came along, they would build bridges across the river so low that the steamboats couldn't get under them. Their smokestacks were too high to pass beneath them. And the railroad guys were here to win. They fought this battle to win it, and they did. The last steamboat, I can't say it was the last steamboat, but steamboat freight as we know it would eventually reach Fort Benton, Montana, the head of river navigation, and the last steamboat left that. By the time the railroad got there in the 1880s, that was pretty much the end of the steamboat era. It was a short era. The first steamboat onto the Missouri River was one called the Independence, and it came west and entered this river in 1819. And then a couple more the next year, and a couple more the next year, and more after that. And by the 1850s, that was considered the golden age of steamboats. There was more boats on the river at that time in history than ever before. Or ever since.
I hear a hint of sadness in your voice when you talk about that was the end, that the steamboat was no longer a viable mode of transportation. Is that just that it's the end of an era, or do you think that there's something we lost?
Well, you know, it is interesting that it was a short era. It lasted one lifetime. It starts in the 20s and ends pretty much by the 1880s. But when you begin to look at the school books, that grade school and high school, look at the way west that they talk about. They talk about wagons going west. They'll talk about the locomotives, but there's and the trails of Santa Fe and the California. They talk about all those, you know, the Oregon Trail, but very little is mentioned about the steamboats. When the steamboat Arabia was excavated and it became, at least in Kansas City, an attraction that many school kids come to see, kids have now become a little bit more acquainted with the steamboats and its importance. But really little is written, and there's a lot that has been lost to that way of travel. And it was so important. For example, in the state of Missouri, where do you suppose the capital of Missouri was located? It was on the bank of the Missouri River, as was Bismarck, North Dakota, and Pierre, South Dakota, on these bordering states that would include the Missouri River. That's where the capitals were. That's how you could get there.
I want to jump in and ask how Kansas City's development patterns changed when steamboats finally did give way to railroads.
Well, when the Hannibal Bridge came across the Missouri River, the city turns its attention to the rail. Trains could run year-round, while steamboats were shut down during the winter season. You couldn't get through the ice. The river was too low. But rail provided a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week possibility for travel. And then the city began to grow south. From the bank of the Missouri River, the little town of Westport would come to the river there we talked earlier at the foot of Grand at the landing. That was called Westport Landing because of that. The town of Kansas, as it was called in those early days, would then grow further to the south, and it would move south further and further and further, turning its back to the river, and eventually pretty much forgot about it, which continues sorted to the day. You know, we cross the river, we look at it, we see it, those of us who traveled back and forth almost every day, knowing really little about it other than it's a scary river. People today are generally afraid of it. They don't use it for water recreation. And now, is it a dangerous river? I mean, but any water is. But Kansas City would grow further away from the river. Now, in the grass and in the trees and in the debris along that river, right there near Kansas City, right there near the River Market area, are the footings and the foundations of what was known at that time as the town of Kansas. They're out there. You can still see them somewhere if you look carefully through the grass. But that's all that's left now of the original town where the steamboats pulled in and what would become the town that we know and love today.
David Hawley, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.